broadcasting before and probably after the rapture. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
Well, for our regular listeners out there, that's Tim on the flute, on the jazz flute. It's Soul Survivor time. You know what that music means. Religious tribes competing for the soul of one person. 3 years ago we did it and people thought we were nuts. And so we are back with it again. Tribal leaders explain to our soul survivor what it is that their tribe actually believes, and the tribal leaders will not have immunity. Our soul survivor will be able to challenge, critique, or question any aspect of all tribal codes. At the end of the contest, our soul survivor will then decide which tribe presented the most compelling case for faith, and then maybe reveal to us if they'll be maybe joining that tribe. Ryan has been our soul survivor, contestant, for lack of a better word, over the last number of weeks. And I got a phone call this morning from one of Ryan's friends saying that he was incapacitated and unable to make it today on the show. And so had to make a quick call to one of our soul survivor, what we call
applicants.
Them
applicants, you call them.
Yes, applicants. And a gentleman who has willingly stayed around and become part of our tribal council. Because at the end of every segment, one of our finalists, who weren't chosen to be this year's soul survivor, they join us on the phone and give us their thoughts of the interview that we just had. So let's see, who's going to be? That's Matt, who we're calling today, I believe. Right. But anyway, stepping in and pinch-hitting for Ryan is Greg, as we like to call him around here, Greg Double G.
Greg Double G, and thank you. It's glad to be here, and it's nice to be the new Miss Columbia.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. Well said. And I'm Steve Harvey,
You are.
Is that how that works?
At least you read the right name.
He's an interesting guy. I'd like to get him on the show and hear his story.
He's a funny guy.
Yeah. So, representing Tribe Muslim today is Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correct. And so, Tribe Muslim is the group we're going to be speaking about and with today. Like all tribes, like all religious tribes, though, Greg, you know, one person does not represent the whole tribe.
Absolutely.
There are various factions within every tribe, and liberal and conservative, and et cetera, fundamentalists, and whatever else. And so, yeah, you're really just sort of getting an overall sort of synopsis from Sheikh Hamza. Have you discovered since kind of looking into him? What do you know about him?
Well, I think it's interesting looking at what they're doing in the college in California with promoting Islam and doing the teachings. But, you know, to your earlier point, I have a list of questions that I want to ask, but none of the questions is about the extremism or some of the violence we're seeing, because I get the feeling that's already been, you know, really done to death, and it'd be nice to just move into some more interesting areas about Islam. But the one interesting thing, and what I really want to lead with asking him, or you could ask him, is his conversion to Islam.
Oh, yeah.
In 1977.
Because he's an American guy.
He must have been raised Christian.
He's not an Arab.
Right. And so I was asking all these questions, or putting down questions saying, you know, if I were to convert, what would I expect? What would my wife expect, for example? And I thought, no, let's just ask him about his conversion.
Yeah.
Because that's really analogous to where we are right now, looking and saying maybe something else and coming up out of a Christian background.
Yeah. So, what do you think? What do you believe? Because people don't know you, because you're pinch-hitting for Ryan today.
I am.
Just give us a quick synopsis of you.
You know, raised culturally Christian in a WASP household, but with a flaky single mom who was really into fraudulent Tibetan lamas and
fraudulent Tibetan lamas.
Remember, I was
what
telling you,
yeah, they are.
Yeah, they are. They're no rhythm at all.
No
rhythm, eh? They're just. So, you know, I was in a pretty open environment, and my children, for example, have hardly ever entered a church in their life. But I was raised culturally Christian. You know, we had the Lord's Prayer, you knew all the Bible stories, you watched, what was that, a cartoon on Sundays?
Oh, Davy
and Goliath, yeah.
Davy.
You know, and
yep.
And so I'm already Christian at heart, because I think I'm raised in that environment. But for the most part, I've been looking at Stoicism, Confucianism. You know, mostly
it's hard to understand that stuff.
Those in Buddhism are more like self-help type of things. They're
You're
not
saying it's very confusing.
Thanks, confusing.
Dan. So, what about Islam? What have you looked into? What do you know? What kind of presuppositions do you come with? in this conversation?
I think some of them, you know, they're, I'll give you a positive one to start with, because I think there's a lot of negativity. My understanding of Islam, certainly through a couple thousand years of history, was they were often the beacon of light and learning, very advanced in mathematics, sciences, and were usually the most accommodating to other religions and other nationalities to come to their centers of learning and contribute. So when Europe was in the Dark Ages, you know, Islam was hanging on to all that knowledge, you know, from the Greeks and everybody else. So they had, you know, a very strong history of valuing learning and education and the arts. The negative stuff, I guess it's what everybody hears right now.
Well, you're not going to go into that, but I want to just ask him a couple of questions. So why don't we just move along and get to the phone here.
Can I ask you, Drew?
Yes.
Do we refer to him as Sheikh Yusuf?
What a great question.
Because that means like an elder or learned?
I would like to also know what his, I wonder if it's disrespectful to ask what his American name was. You see, eh? Before Muhammad Ali, he was Cassius Clay.
Cat Stevens.
Cat Stevens, that's right. So, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf is on the phone. Sir, the first question we have respectfully is, how do we refer to you?
For this, I'm fine with Hamza. That's fine.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll just make it simple.
Thank you, Hamza.
I was once on an airplane, and this guy recognized me. I had a television program in the Arab world, and he just started telling me how much he loved my work, and he just was such a big fan, and he went on and on and on. And after about 10 minutes of accolades, he said, "But just why did you quit singing?" And I said, "No, that's a different Yusuf. That's Yusuf Islam."
Yusuf Islam. Yeah. That's funny. Too funny. Now, is it?
I was tempted to say I lost my voice, but I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. You also were on a no-fly list, so you couldn't tour. let's just talk. I mean, do you mind if I ask you about your sort of previous life? You know, do you like
shoot away as long as there's no bullets?
Okay, got it. What was your American name?
I was named after a Columbia professor, liberal arts professor, Mark Van Doren. My father was a student of Van Doren at Columbia for 3 years and was very influenced by him, so he named me after that. My middle name was Jordan, which was named after a philosophy professor my father worked with. My father was a professor at Whitman College in philosophy and humanities. My last name is Hansen, which originally was Ohansach. It's a Gaelic name, Irish. But my great-grandfather, Michael Ohansach, came to Philadelphia in 1838. And in those days, it wasn't too cool to have an O on your name. And now you can be Obama and be president. But in those days, an O was not cool, and so they dropped the O and became Hansen, which was more Anglo-Saxon sounding.
Yeah, I think maybe a better Muslim approach for this whole thing would be, oh my God, would be maybe better.
You know, by the way, my great-grandfather is from Ontario on my...
What?
My from Alexandria. He's actually buried there. We have a mausoleum there for the Chisholm.
Wow. Wow, so there's a connection. Well, so listen, the reason we reached out to you is because we have a regular guest on our show. His name is Mubin Sheikh, and Mubin is the author of a book called Undercover Jihadi. He's a former jihadist, and then CSIS, the Canadian spy agency, basically got him on board, and he infiltrated the Toronto 18 and helped to break up some terrorist plots, and he's kind of a big deal, and he's a big deal, and he said, "You think I'm a big deal? Oh my goodness!" He called you the rock star of Islam. Like, there's actually another quote out there, other people calling you the Elvis Presley of Islam. That's got to be weird to hear that.
Well, definitely very strange, because I don't dance like Elvis.
No,
so,
no. Yeah. Sometimes people call me the Howard Stern of Christian radio, but I don't know if I like
that. Wow.
You've got nicer hair.
Thank you. I would like to introduce the two of you, please, if you don't mind. Folks, you are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca. We're live right here in Southern Ontario on Joy 1250. On the phone with Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. He is representing Tribe Muslim during our Soul Survivor segment that we're doing. And this is basically just kind of a fun way for our listeners to understand from the horse's mouth, so to speak, various religious leaders coming on and explaining to our soul survivor what their faith is really all about, and just giving the average Joe the opportunity to speak with the Elvis of Islam, basically. So, in the studio with us, instead of Ryan, because he is he's not able to make us today, kind of a last-minute change on the bench, we've brought in Greg. Greg, this is Hamza.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Greg, and I really appreciated your introductory remarks just about there's so much negativity, and it's rarely, you know, we get the opportunity to just talk about maybe just normative Islam or some of the positive aspects of Islam. Everybody's always wanting to know what Islam isn't instead of what it is.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and I think anytime we get into discussions about extreme behavior in any of the religions, you just end up on a bit of a dead-end street. I mean, we can point to any of the major religions and issues and difficulties. So after a little while, it kind of runs out. I'd prefer to learn a little bit more about the faith of Islam. So,
first question for you, from you, Greg, would be what?
First question, Hamza, can you share with us what led to your conversion? I noticed in your bio you converted to Islam in 1977. You're ostensibly brought up as a Christian, so it plays very well into what we're looking at today, which is sort of alternatives to Christianity or different forms of it. So my question is, what prompted your conversion? What can you share with us about that?
Well, I had a what they call near-death experience. I was in a head-on collision, and which really forced me to just deal with mortality and thinking a lot about death and what happens, because I realized, you know, at 17, which is pretty tender age, I really realized that I just could have died, and I didn't really feel, I felt embryonic spiritually. I didn't really feel prepared. Is there something after life? I mean, I was taught that there was. I was raised, my grandfather was Orthodox. He was an archon in the Orthodox Church, so I was actually raised Orthodox. I went to Catholic schools, and so I got a pretty solid dose of traditional Christianity. But my mother, her mother was actually very interested in Buddhism back in the 1920s and moved with her brother out to San Francisco. And my uncle opened Fields Bookstore, which was one of the first metaphysical bookstores back in the 30s in San Francisco. So they were interested in spirituality. And my mother basically taught us, myself and my brothers and sisters, that religion is often very an arbitrary thing, that you're born into a family and you're told certain things, and you grow up believing those things to be truth, but it's really, in essence, far more arbitrary than we'd like to imagine. And so she really raised us to be open-minded about the possibility of truth being outside of one's own experience.
What's your follow-up to that story, to his journey?
Well, I got the donut, but I'm missing the hole here.
When I had that experience, I really decided to just look at all the religions and what they had to say about afterlife. And it's interesting, in the recent book, The Study of Quran, that just came out with Harper Perennial, I wrote the last essay in there on death in the Quran. I got very interested in death and dying and looked at all these various religions, and I was really struck by the eschatology or the afterlife narrative that Islam had. It just, I don't think there's a tradition that has a richer description of the afterlife than Islam.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because, Drew, you can vouch for me. My second question written here,
I'm going to vouch. I'm going to go look.
What happens when I die? Is there a heaven in Islam? And if so, what does that look like?
There are many descriptions in the Quran about both hell and heaven, but all of the great exegetes of Islam, the commentators of the Quran, all of them argue that these are just approximations, that the ultimate statement about the afterlife is what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, and what has never occurred to the heart. And so the afterlife, though there is a paradise, there are many sensual descriptions in the Quran about paradise, which many historically Christians found to be very offensive. And that's something that you'll find a lot in Orientalist writing, especially in the 19th century. Victorian England, which was quite prudish, was very troubled by the fact that there's, you know, intercourse in the afterlife and things like that. So, you know, there's quite sensual descriptions of rivers, you know, gardens with rivers flowing, and beautiful, you know, servants and children, beautiful children, and what are called the houris, which are these beautiful maidens and things like that. So all those descriptions are there in the Quran, but again, they're approximations.
We can't have a conversation about what happens after you die in the world of Islam without talking about the virgins, right? We got to talk about the virgins.
Well, those are just a special reward, I think.
Can you help us understand how pop culture and media has kind of messed with our heads in regards to the virgins in your world? What's the truth behind the virgins? I just love saying that word, by the way. The virgins.
Yeah. You know, I think virginity, that really the at essence is the idea of purity, and there are companions in paradise that are pure companions, both male and female, and so the males are purified of any taints of this world, and the females are purified. Some of them say that the houris are actually the wives that you're with your wife that you died with, the last wife that you had. And others say that there are virgins that are created, they're paradisical beings that are created for the afterlife. But the highest and ultimate experience in paradise is the beatific vision. And so the Muslims concur with the Catholics that the highest paradise is the vision of God, which is a non-spatial, non-temporal type of experience, and that's very clear that it's not an anthropomorphic. God's not in any location, but there is an experience of the heart's witnessing of God.
Okay, so what I just heard you say was that there are different levels of heaven, and the highest level doesn't have the virgins.
It doesn't have the virgins.
It's like getting promoted, but the wrong way.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry. Yeah. No, it is. I mean, look, as outsiders, as people who, you know, media and whatever else, and Westerners and men, just males thinking about this, and I don't know. It's, you know, there's a reason that your scriptures, your sacred scriptures, talk about this being a reward. It is fascinating.
The thing about, I mean, sexuality is a very central experience in life, and it's certainly one of the great. In fact, Imam al-Ghazali said that sexuality was an experience that God gave us in order to let us get a glimpse of the pleasures of paradise. And so the idea that, you know, the afterlife would not have some element, but it's not a sensual type. I mean, real intimacy, and this is one of the tragedies of modern culture with the hookup culture, real intimacy is much deeper than just a physical experience. Yeah. It's a spiritual experience. And when two people are truly in love, the experience of coming together in intimacy is something very, very spiritual, and that it's always been seen as that in the Islamic tradition. It's not been seen as some kind of, you know, original sin or a taint. It's been seen as a positive thing, much like the Jewish tradition also celebrates that aspect of human experience.
Sure, sure. Well, speaking of
but
Judaism,
it's not a type of lustful. I mean, people, you know, get your heads out of the gutter. You know, there's a lot of people that just want to be down in that, you know, that mundane, profane place, and that's why one of the things that Dorothy Sayers says about our culture, and she said this back in the 40s, is that when people lose their spiritual bearings, very often they fall into lust as a replacement for spiritual experience. Because, Nietzsche talks about the Apollonian and the Dionysian nature, you know, the orderly and then that chaotic disorderly. And there's something very Dionysian about sexuality, that people get lost in it, and our society is really, really, I think, being greatly harmed by this obsession, pornography, and all these things that we have so many young people now being exposed to sexuality as a physical thing as opposed to a spiritual thing.
Well, that's a good point. And one of the questions I wanted to ask of you just a little later on was the role of obedience and adherence, strict adherence to Islam. But just before we get to that part, I do have a question for you with respect to heaven, just one little last one. If I look at the tenets or the pillars of faith for Islam, they state that there is only one God, so that the God of the Christians, the God of the Jews, and the Muslims are all it's the same God. Would that not mean that we'd all have the same heaven? Are we not all going to meet everyone up there?
To quote Seals and Crofts?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the... you know, we do have the same God. There are different concepts. I mean, the Wheaton College event where this tenured professor, you know, was basically challenged because she said that we worship the same God with the Muslims. A lot of Christians don't believe that. I think the Catholics do, and certainly the Orthodox Christians. But
Muslims believe that, right? So from your perspective...
I mean, it's very clear the Quran says...
Am I going to be in your heaven? Do I get in?
The Quran clearly states that the Jews, the Christians, the Sabians, that people that believe in God in the last day will be in paradise. But Muslims also believe that if somebody rejects the truth knowingly, that they don't go to paradise. And so Imam al-Ghazali, who died in 1111 in the Christian era, one of the greatest theologians of Islam, said that as long as somebody is actively searching for the truth and dies in that pursuit without denying the truth, then they will be saved. That was his view, and that's the view that I find most comfortable with personally. And the descriptions of the people that are in hell in the Quran are hard-hearted people, they're cruel people. The descriptions are clearly people that hate the truth, that oppose the truth, and there's certainly a lot of people like that on this planet, unfortunately.
Right. Well, like the hard-hearted woman that Cat Stevens wrote about. Thank you. All right, I just want to do a little summarization of things here, because I've got a friend. His name is James Beverly, and he's written Religions A to Z, A Guide to 100 Influential Religious Movements. He's also written a whole lot of sort of encyclopedic books. And I want to skim through some of his points in this book, and I just want to make sure that this is accurate, if you don't mind. And it's sort of, here we go, this is Islam 101. So let's start with pronunciation. Is it Shahada?
Shahada. Yeah.
That's confession of faith. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. Yeah. The next one.
Allah, let's just quickly, though. Allah is the word that the Jewish and the Christian Arabs use for God. So this idea of, you know, that it's some different God is not. They call Jesus in Arabic Ibn Allah.
Okay.
The son of Allah.
So these are the five pillars of Islam. And the second one is Salat. Is that how you say it?
Salat. Yeah,
Salat. Prayer. All Muslims are to pray five times per day facing Mecca, the holiest city. Number three.
If they're an adult. Yeah.
If they're an adult. Okay.
Yeah.
Number three, Zakat.
Now you're doing great.
Okay. Tithing.
I teach Arabic. I'm giving you an A so far.
Thank you. Beautiful. I've never gotten an A in anything. This is awesome. Muslims must give financially to the poor and the needy. This involves giving at least 2.5% of their total wealth. Boy, that's cheaper than the Christian program. I like that.
You know, the taxation is pretty good, you know, and if we had a flat tax of 2.5 on this planet, we would have a surplus.
Yeah.
It's been actually proven.
Psalm? Fasting?
Yeah, psalm, yeah.
Psalm? Yeah. Okay, during the holy month of Ramadan, Muslims are to refrain from food, water, and sex from sunrise to sunset.
Yeah, if they're an adult and if they're healthy. So sickness is, you know, you don't have to. And children, some do, but in some schools it's discouraged because it's not healthy.
Hajj, which is...
Hajj.
Yeah, that's a pilgrimage. As much as possible, at least once in a lifetime, Muslims are to travel to Mecca to engage in rituals of prayer and worship at the central shrine in Islam's holiest city. So those are the five pillars of Islam.
If you're able to financially, and it's specifically said in the Quran, whoever's able to, to make the pilgrimage.
Now, as far as the Quran is concerned, Muslims believe that the Quran is the perfect word of Allah. The Quran contains 114 chapters or surahs. Muslims believe that the Quran was revealed to Muhammad by the archangel Gabriel, and the Quranic material was composed from 610 through Muhammad's death in 632, and the final compilation of the Quran was completed about 650. True story?
That's all accurate.
Okay. What is the biggest conflict between the Quran and the Bible?
There are many things. The Quran asserts that the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, are revelations from God, so it asserts that. There is a belief, though, that they were corrupted, that the scribes did not, transmit them correctly. So there's a belief, most Muslims believe that the Bible and the New Testament have corruptions. And so, there's a gospel called, the source gospel, which is the gospel of Q. And a lot of Christians have written about this, especially in Tübingen in Germany. There was a lot of research on this. The original gospel before the four canonical gospels emerged. And so Muslims believe in the original gospel of Jesus. And they believe that Jesus was born of a virgin birth, that he was the Messiah. The vast majority of Muslims believe in the second coming of Christ, but they do not believe that Jesus was God.
Right. So Jesus was a prophet of God, but not the Son of God. He was born of the Virgin Mary. He performed many miracles. He did not die on the cross. He did not rise from an empty tomb. He ascended to heaven after his death. He was a faithful Muslim or follower of Allah, and he predicted the ministry of Muhammad.
That's basically the Muslims believe that the paraclete, which in Greek is parakletos, the comforter or the advocate, which is one of the names of the Prophet Muhammad, they believe that the paraclete mentioned in John is a reference. Traditional Christian interpretation is that it's the Holy Ghost, but the Holy Ghost was with Christ at the time, so he said, "One is coming after me, and I have to go so that he can come." So that's a belief that the parakletos was the prediction of the Prophet Muhammad, and the word for paraclete in Aramaic was Muhammadan, and so a lot of the Syriac Christians, when the Prophet showed up, many Christians embraced Islam in the Holy Land because they saw it as a fulfillment. A lot of the Arians also, because many of the Christian sects in that area were not of Orthodox or Catholic tradition, but they were the Malachites, the Monophysites, the Chaldean Church, the Malabari Nasara. So there were a lot of Christian sects at that time.
All right. I'm looking across the board here at my engineer. We call him Tim the Tool.
Yeah, so this will probably be a bad question.
No, you're a nice boy, Tim. Go ahead. What's your question?
Now, I know I have this own personal struggle with the words of Jesus and then the books outside of Jesus, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and some people like to misquote.
You're saying you have a problem with
how some of those other books are being used and how sometimes a guest before said that, Jesus kind of gets left out of the equation when we're dealing with stuff and we quote other books that are considered canonical. And so, with regards to the Quran, and I know there are other books that are considered, for lack of a better word, canonical in Islam. Where does Wahhabism, because we've talked about this before, where does that extreme form come from? And enter into this. Is this part of the Quran, or these books that were written outside of the Quran? It's something I've always tried to understand.
Did you say Wahhabism?
Yes, sorry. I probably said it wrong.
Yeah. Well, look, the Muslims are not monolithic, and so you have the vast majority of Muslims historically have been called Sunnis, with about 15% called Shia. Within those groups, there's also some differences, but overall, both of those groups, the Sunnis and Shias, accepted each other as Muslims. They differed on certain things, but they did not excommunicate or anathematize the other. There is a strain of Islam that emerged about 200 years ago that was a reformist movement. It's very much in line with the kind of puritanical Christian movements that emerged in England as well. And so in essence, they're kind of like the best of them are like grumpy Amish. You know, they just kind of want to be left alone
with weapons.
And the worst of them are like the worst of the Ku Klux Klan, and it's kind of between that. So unfortunately, it's a reality that we have to deal with as a community. Now, one of the problems is that the petrodollars has enabled massive amounts of literature that I would consider pretty extreme to flood the Arab world. And so a lot of modern Arab youth have really been indoctrinated into a type of Islam that historically was very alien to Islam. And the bitter fruit of that is now emerging in places like Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Yemen. But historically, the Muslims, I mean, they have a lot of blights on their history, undeniably. But overall, I think Greg mentioned earlier, you know, for a pre-modern civilization, it was one of the most enlightened. It was certainly highly tolerant of other cultures and civilizations. It was very eclectic. It took from other cultures and civilizations. And also, it protected Christian churches. There's a reason why those churches are being destroyed now in Iraq. Why weren't they destroyed before? Why were they standing for over 1,000 years? The Christians were there long before the Muslims, and the Muslims honored them. And you can look at the Syriac writings. A Muslim has the key to the Church of the Sepulchre. To this day, he opens it every morning at dawn to resolve one of the conflicts that the Christians had when the Muslims first got there. So, and I was just with, we were in Marrakesh for a conference protecting religious minorities in the Muslim land. And there was a Yazidi man from Iraq. His name is Baba Sheikh. You can Google him. He's one of the Yazidi leaders. He was there. He came up to me after his talk. I was talking to him, and he said, listen, nobody amongst the Yazidis believes this is Islam. We know what Islam is. He said, I know Islam better than most Muslims. He said, we've lived with Muslims for centuries, and that's why we're still here. These are criminals. And the truth is, many of these, you know, these Sabians and Yazidis and Druze and these other religious groups, they know that this is not Islam. But unfortunately, it only takes one generation to break that link.
Oh, yeah.
And so people are going to forget. And that's my fear, you know, is that people will start associating these things with Islamic behavior.
Well, representing Tribe Muslim on a segment on our show we're calling Soul Survivor is Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. That's who you're listening to on the phone. Our stand-in Soul Survivor today, because Ryan couldn't make it, is Greg. That's Tim on the other end of the microphone as well. And let's go back to you, Greg, with your list of questions that you so professionally researched and came to the show with.
I did. I typed all
Thank
by
you.
Myself.
Well done.
Thank you.
Good boy.
I have a question with respect to you have the pillars of Islam, and we're talking about fundamentalism. At what point can I still be a good Muslim but still be secular? If I'm in Canadian or American society,
great question.
And if I'm not following certain dietary practices, perhaps I'm not doing the praying. Like, at what point do I get kicked out of Islam?
Great question.
It's almost impossible to get kicked out of Islam. I mean, you really have to do something egregious.
No, the Christians are better at that.
You know, the Christians really put water in your head when you're born and you're in, and right?
Historically, it was all... We have a saying of Abu Hanifa, one of the great jurists of Islam from the second century of the Islamic tradition and the founder of the largest school of jurisprudence. Abu Hanifa said, it's better to mistake 1,000 people believing they're Muslims than to mistake one Muslim as a non-believer. So it's better to be mistaken about 1,000 non-believers and assume they're Muslims than it is to assume one Muslim as a non-believer. And so it's pretty hard to get kicked out of Islam. You have to do something really egregious.
Can you marry outside of your faith?
You can marry outside of your faith. Women are not allowed to marry outside of their faith because of the fear that they'll be converted by the husband. So that's traditionally been a prohibition. And although there are Muslim women that do marry outside of their faith, but historically that's that's the position of Islam.
We have an intern here. Her name is Megs. And, you know, I thought it would be better if Megs asked you the what about women question in Islam than me, because, it well, I'm sure you could do the math. Yeah. So, Megs, this is Hamza.
Hi there. How's it going?
Megs, it's going well.
Good. Just thought I'd make a little small talk before I jumped into things with you. So like the big thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, I feel like there's a lot of misconceptions around women's issues and Islam and just the Muslim culture in general. And I want to know what some of the big ones are. What are some things people seem to be a little confused about?
Well, I would say, first of all, women overall in many of our civilizations have really had a hard time, and still, even here, I think we have a lot of problems, you know. So I think overall, men have not done a great job at honoring women. But the Prophet Muhammad said, the best of you are the best of you to women, folk. And he said, no one honors a woman except an honorable man, and no one denigrates a woman except a degraded man. And historically, people, in this enlightened age, we can look back on the past, but people don't realize the revolutions that occurred with the Prophet Muhammad and women. In fact, if you read Florence Nightingale's, I actually wrote an article called Florence of Arabia. She lived in Egypt and wrote a beautiful essay about Islam, and she actually just found that, you know, the attitudes were very high, but she felt that the women were very oppressed in Egypt. And she said, I kept hearing my heart say, turn to Mecca, turn to Mecca. And then she said, oh, if only there was a place for women in this religion. And I think, you know, there's a lot of problems in the Muslim world vis-a-vis women, because these are patriarchal societies that I think in many ways the Prophet tried to undermine a lot of the patriarchy that existed in the Arab culture, but it was quickly reestablished. And so I think there's a lot I'll just give you an example. In my school, which is the Maliki school, a woman does not have to do any domestic chores by law. And this was literally legislated over 1,000 years ago, that she could charge for domestic work, her husband. You know, her money is discretionary. It's her own. She's allowed to work. The Prophet Muhammad's wife was a merchant, Khadija. She was a merchant. She actually supported the Prophet himself. And so there are a lot of things, but there's definitely problems, and that is undeniable. And I think a lot of Muslim apologists would maybe take on budget that.
Right, okay. So look, from Meg's point of view, I asked her to step in on this because, you know, she's a 20-something-year-old, she's in university, you know, hanging out with, and influenced by her peers and media. And so what she is inundated with, Hamza, is, of course, you know what she's inundated. She's inundated with conversations about burqas, about hijabs, honor killings.
Most of those things, first of all, honor killings are totally prohibited in Islam. That's cultural, and the Christian Arabs do that as well. There are honor killings in Jordan by Christian Arabs, so that is a cultural phenomenon. Genital mutilation is a cultural phenomenon. It's only in East Africa, and both the animists, the Christians, as well as the Muslims, all practice clitorectomies. But clitorectomies do not occur in any other places in the Muslim world. It's not part of Islam. So this idea of genital, like, you know, Ayan Hirsi always talks about genital mutilation in Somalia. That's a cultural pre-Islamic practice that was done. And it doesn't, the Moroccan women have never heard of that. You know, Tunisian women, North African, Libyan women, they've never heard of that. So those are cultural. In terms of the hijab, both men and women are told to dress modestly, and this is something in Judaism. Orthodox Jewish women cover their heads, or they wear a wig. In Christianity, the women were told to cover their heads. Traditionally, if you look at all our paintings from our Christian past, you'll see women. Every picture of the Virgin Mary of traditional shows her in a scarf. nuns wore what's very similar to a hijab. And so those things were just, those are part of the Abrahamic religious tradition that Muslims adhere to. The burqa, covering the face, is a cultural phenomenon. There are undeniably some opinions in among scholars that women should cover their face, but those are opinions. They're, mm-hmm. they're not from God. They're interpretations of men saying, well, when God says, tell the believing women to cover their ornaments, well, the face is the biggest ornament, so that means the face. But other scholars said, no, it doesn't, because it's not fair to the women to force them to cover their faces. So that's
I actually had a question about hijab specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know, where do you think the idea of the oppressed Muslim woman came from in terms of hijab and burqas and things like that?
Well, I think part of it is that most Muslim societies, West Africa notwithstanding and maybe Malaysia, most Muslim societies, especially Arab societies, are very segregated. And so you don't really see the women. Ottoman society was like that also. And so because of that, I think when Europeans went into the Muslim world, you know, they just saw the women as being hidden away.
Mm-hmm.
But again, these are more cultural phenomena. During the Prophet's time, the women were clearly engaged.
Okay, but hold on. If Muslim women over here are born in Canada, raised in Canadian culture, and yet they're still covering up, it's no longer a cultural thing. It seems like it's the religion says we got to do it, so we do it.
Yeah, no, the hijab is part of the religion, and I think that most Muslim women in the West do not cover, but the ones that do cover out of religious conviction, and most of them do it by choice. I know many women whose husbands didn't want them to cover, and they're covering in spite of their husbands because they believe that they're told to. The same is true for fathers. A lot of fathers don't want their daughters to cover, and so but the covering of the head is definitely, that's considered normative.
Okay.
Islam.
All right, we got it.
It's not a major thing. Like, you know, Muslims have made this kind of a sine qua non of being a devout Muslim woman, which is problematic to me because there are many devout women that dress modestly but do not cover their heads. But to say that, you know, that that's not part of the religion, I think would also be wrong as well.
Okay. Maybe to take it on a slightly different direction, Hamza.
Yes, Greg.
I have a question for you about, you were talking about the segregation of some Arab societies and different countries, you know, producing sort of a different form of it. Of all the nations in the world today, which country best exemplifies the tenets of Islam? What's the most successful Muslim country that you would point to say, if you want to understand more about Islam, this is the country that embodies best the tenets of our religion?
I would say Canada.
Well, let me make it harder for you. What I'm asking is, which predominantly Muslim countries would you say, you know, like, it's not always fair to throw Afghanistan or Iran or some different things into the mix,
yeah,
all the time.
You're putting me between Iraq and a hard place.
He's here all week, folks.
But I guess if I wanted to,
you know, I would have to say probably Malaysia or Turkey are the best examples that we have right now. I think Senegal is also very impressive. Gambia is I think good. I have a soft spot for Morocco. I studied there and I love Moroccan culture. But overall, the Muslims are not doing that well right now. And I was not being facetious or flattering to say that Canada best embodies Islamic tradition. I think I really think that the Canadian society I think reflects so many of the values of Islam in its tolerance, in its social services, the way it takes care of the weak in the culture. I think Trudeau's extraordinary gesture of charity towards the Syrian refugees has just been a stunning example to the rest of the world about how we should be looking at these things. And I really mean these things seriously. I thought we were all brought to tears watching the Canadian children sing "Tala al-Badr alayna" to greet the Syrian refugees. It was just so moving to see that. So, and I know Canada has its problems, but there are many, many beautiful things in Canada that reflect the best of my tradition.
Sure. Well, I guess to your point with Canada, when I was looking at this Soul Survivor contest that Drew has, we're supposed to be looking outside of perhaps Christian faith or questioning and talking to the different tribes to say, you know, which one should I go for? Which one, you know, as a opportunity to everyone to learn, to learn a bit more. And when I did some looking myself, it was interesting because one of the conclusions I had to come to was that of all the safest countries in the world where I'd send my 25-year-old daughter, they're all Christian, you know, and not just to say that as throwing something across the bow of the Muslims, but the Hindus, even parts of Israel. The only place that I would feel safe or that I would say are some of the most successful countries in the world, safest countries in the world, are all Christian, and for the most part, the majority of them are former British Commonwealth countries. So as much as, you know, I find that's an interesting disparity across the world. I mean, it's quite a divergence. Yeah. You fly out of London into a country in Africa, and you know, the world is completely different.
Hamza?
Well, I mean, I think that I wouldn't say that it's so much because they're Christian, but I think...
Or they were Christian, but...
Yeah, they were, but I think a lot of it has to do with civil society and the institutions that have arisen in the West are quite exceptional, and I believe in some aspects of Western exceptionalism, and it's undeniably true that a lot of what has been achieved, but there's also, I mean, if you look at the domestic abuse, if you look at the rape statistics that we have, if you look at, there's a whole other side that's actually quite dark, you know, so I don't think, I wouldn't paint it as glossy maybe as, and I deal a lot with these statistics. Professor Fish at Berkeley University wrote a book about are Muslims distinct, and the social science was pretty strong that stable Muslim societies are actually safer than Western Muslim society, societies. And he was not a Muslim; he just wanted to check the data for himself. But unstable Muslim societies are quite terrible. And having said that, I would say that generally sexual harassment is a problem in the Muslim world, and that's quite tragic. That was brought to my attention by somebody who I really respect a lot, Jennifer Bryson, who I had made a statement about that I've really never felt safer than I have when I've been in Muslim cities. I don't have the same feeling in Western cities. Like I've never felt under threat in Morocco at 12 midnight in Rabat or anywhere, and I've always felt very safe.
Sure, man, societies. Right? You send your 25-year-old daughter to those countries.
And
see, that's where
I have to agree with you, and I think that is not that does not reflect on Islam. I think it really reflects on the very degraded state of women in Muslim societies
and others as well.
Malcolm X said that, you know, that ultimately a society flourishes based on how it treats its women, and I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think there's a reason why the Muslim societies are in such horrific conditions right now.
I've just got to say, to have Gandhi's grandson on last week, Arun Gandhi, and to have you on this week, what a great thing. I'm sorry. This is a great radio show.
My brain hurts.
I agree.
I guess I'm fawning over you because I'm looking at the clock realizing we've got to let you go and have a life and we've got to move on. But I would love to have you back on at some point in the future. You have been, I don't even know what to say.
Patient.
You've been patient with with us. So thank you, Hamza, for that. But you are a fantastic communicator, and this is why, you know, your organizations that you're part of, your university, this is why there is growth around you and there is peace around you. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you. And what you're doing is so important Gandhi's best friend, and Arun would confirm this, I'm sure, Gandhi's best friend was a great Muslim scholar, Abul Kalam Azad. They were companions throughout their life. Abul Kalam translated the Quran, wrote a commentary on it. He was born in Mecca. He was the closest person to Gandhi. He was the only one that never abandoned Gandhi. And to this day, India celebrates the National Education Day with the birthday of Abul Kalam Azad. Gandhi said about him, his peers are Plato and Pythagoras. He was a beautiful man, and Gandhi wrote a wonderful introduction to a book of sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. And Gandhi used to really always say, "I'm a Muslim as well as a Hindu."
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was genuine because of his interaction. But thank you so much. And, you know, I wish the best. Canada, you know, I think every time I look at the political situation, I think about seeing if there's some way to finagle Canadian citizenship based on my great-grandfather being from Ontario.
There you go.
if Trump gets in, I just, you know, it's the last straw, I think. You know, it's not a Trump card.
Oh.
It's much worse.
Yeah.
So, but I'm really I go to Canada every year, and I love the place, and God bless all of you, and really thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Sheikh Hamza Youssef. I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, I want to get Matt on the phone. Are you there, sir?
I'm here, buddy.
I am so sorry to rip you off. Yeah, I made you listen to that.
Drew does that to everybody, I think.
I rip
makes
off
you wait
everybody.
All hour. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So listen, at the end of every sort of Soul Survivor, we do a little thing with our tribal council, and this is one of our tribal council's members. Matt, your synopsis of that?
I thought Cat Stevens was smart. I thought, to be honest, like when the whole thing happened with Buddy from Mormonism hanging up, I said, there's a lot of bad things going on in Islam, but there's people that can answer these questions.
Yeah.
And that guy answers those questions.
There's some tough questions.
There were tough questions, and he knocked them out of the park. And, like, when you said that he was smart, that was an understatement. That guy can really bring it home. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
And he was honest, too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I think I need to get you back in here again too. So because I feel bad, it's guilt driven. Okay, I want you back in here, man. We got to get you back in.
Oh well, thanks a lot. It's a pity vote, right?
Yeah, that's it.
All right. I don't want to come back.
Yeah, I don't want to. Thank you. I appreciate that. Just your hanging in there and being with us. We will get the gang back together again. Okay, it's going to happen. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it, dude.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
bye bye.
That's the end of the Drew Marshall Show. Thank you for tuning in. It's been a doozy, and we're back next week with even more stuff. Hey, may you find the God who sees you.
I'm a liberal backslider, and it sure is a lot of fun. I'm a liberal.